listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, February 11th at 5:30 p.m. This will be a hybrid meeting. It will be held at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if...
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
In Hawaii, I grew up in a very small rural community on a still active sugar plantation. You know, looking forward to a life in which I assumed that I would work in agriculture. The future didn't exactly look bright, but it looked predictable. I grew up in a family where my parents always knew that I was gay, or at least had some inkling about it, and hated me for it. They also loved me as their son, but I felt that hatred. I felt the intimidation. It was intentional to make sure that I would never actually act on the impulse that they felt I had. I would run away from home in my little rural community and go to Waikiki. I occasionally had to resort to sex work and other ways of keeping my head above water. When you're a gay, homeless teen, particularly in the 70s, the vulnerability you experience is so extraordinary. There's no place to turn. If I were trying to get by befriending tourists at the gay bars, if somebody decided to beat me up, they could do it with impunity. And the cops did target and harass and go after gay youth. There's just no more helpless feeling than being a 15-year-old gay kid standing at one end of a dark alley from cops who you know are about to descend on you. So I recognized it would be very difficult for myself in this small, culturally conservative community to make a life for myself. And I was a person who had ideas and wanted to do things, wanted to try and experiment and learn and grow. While there's certainly a rich life to be had in rural Oahu, I set myself sights elsewhere, and I decided to leave Hawaii and move to Oregon.
That's Scott Nakagawa. We heard Scott talk about the history of white supremacy in the Pacific Northwest in the last episode. Scott's now senior partner of Change Lab, an Asian American-led racial justice think tank with offices in Oakland and Seattle. Scott moved to Oregon from Hawaii in 1986. He was one of a number of activists who began organizing against neo-Nazis after the murder of Mulugeta Sera.
You know, it was kind of a big shock to come here, to go from a multiracial setting like Hawaii to a place like Portland, the whitest major city in the United States. And my immediate experience upon getting here was basically being shocked by dominance of a white perspective in this community. I literally came here and thought, when I listened to progressive white leaders in the community talking about issues, that they were intentionally trying to exclude people of color. It took me a while to figure out that it was completely unintentional and that it wasn't just like hurt your feelings racism that was being thrown around, but a kind of ignorance bred of the hegemony of whiteness in this community. So it was kind of a big shock.
Scott's description of shock is a common experience for people who move to Portland from multiracial communities. How do we organize against white supremacy in such an overwhelmingly white environment?
So following the Sera murder, something happened here which really surprised people, which is that hate crime statistics in this city went up, where typically it's a case where something like that happens in a community. Hate crime statistics go down. Hate crime statistics here started to go up and up and up. And so it was an indication of a problem, something more than just a one-off. There was a real problem here. Portland had a disproportionate number of anti-LGBTQ violent attacks on African-Americans. If you were African-American in the city of Portland at the time, time, you're 10 times more likely to be visited by hate crime than a white person. If you're an African American, often the attacks were organized. There was a very big problem with anti-Asian violence here. It was growing really rapidly. A lot of the indicators said we were in real trouble. And then Jewish communities started to be attacked, and we recognized that this was more trouble than we even imagined, right? Because when white nationalist groups rise and attack Jewish communities, display that kind of anti-Semitism, it reveals a sort of political sophistication and connection to movements internationally that we didn't anticipate sleepy old Portland back in those days would have.
Under sleepy old Portland's veneer of liberal chill, tensions had begun to surface, tensions that white founders had long ago planted in the seeds of a society settled on stolen land. Racist skinheads in the Pacific Northwest had for some years posed a chronic and now increasing threat to marginalized Portlanders. They flexed power that traveled beyond cornering loners at small and crowded punk shows downtown. Open displays of hate insignia signaled to a growing brotherhood that the Rose City, and eventually the whole region, belonged to them. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're your hosts for this episode of It Did Happen Here, Building Community Defense. We focus on Portlanders who organized in response to a citywide neo-Nazi threat after the 1988 murder of Mulugeta Seral. We'll hear from a number of former members of the grassroots group, the Coalition for Human Dignity. First up is Abby Layton. Abby Layton was a Jewish social justice activist and young mother who became alarmed by the anti-Semitism on open display in the streets of Portland.
At that time, it's so hard to remember, although, you know, we're seeing it happen again. But at that time, what we saw was brown-jacketed neo-Nazi soldiers living in southeast Portland. The idea, which was really scary, was they chose Portland because it was the whitest place that they found. So it was purposely chosen with the idea of creating a movement and then annexing this part of the United States into a separate white supremacist country.
There was a confluence of movements who targeted the Pacific Northwest more generally and Portland specific. That's still going on.
That's Steve Swasserstrom, Reed College professor of Judaic Studies since 1987, at which time he was the only full-time permanent Jewish studies professor across the state of Oregon.
There's a number of other factors. Portland had a long background with ex-Confederates moving here after the Civil War, and then a serious problem with KKK and the housing issues, discrimination of all kinds here. So these folks knew and saw Portland as a special kind of opportunity. So on the one hand, it was this growing, green, and diverse place with liberal representation, and then you had this activity on the other. And they were two separate worlds. That remains true today, unless the group chooses to go out and have a rally down by the river. You might never know that they're out there.
These two worlds of Oregon that Steve mentions resemble many states today, split along an urban-rural divide. Generally speaking, though, Portland was progressive and to the left, while the rural areas ran to the right. But there are deep conservative roots within the city of Portland, and the boundaries between liberal Portland and the conservative rural parts of Oregon are porous and complicated. For some perspective on the regional character, where the religious right intersects with the fascist street movements, we introduce M. Treloar. Originally a white anti-fascist organizer, street protester, activist, and researcher from Chicago, Treloar moved to Portland in 1988 after connecting with Pacific Northwest anti-fascists. We'll be hearing his insights throughout the podcast.
The change in the economic climate in Oregon, where it was making this transition from the timber economy to the modern economy that you see around you now, such as it is, that was throwing all of these folks who otherwise would have had a secure job as adults into a real turmoil as to what am I going to do when I'm grown up, because I can't do what my dad did, creating the basis where neo-Nazis could do some real organizing, which is still the case. while the Boneheads were there, the Oregon Citizens Alliance were always there as well. They had first put forward Measure 8 in 1988. They put forward Measure 9 in 1992 to ban teachers who were gay or lesbian or in some way nonconforming. And then Lon Mabon, who was head of that theocratic group, ran for U.S. Senate on the Republican ticket in 1996. So they were the major force in Oregon Republican politics. They ran the Oregon Republican Party, and they were a theocratic group. And a little bit batshit crazy, they almost won on all of those measures. So while they were doing their let's attack queer people, let's get rid of abortions, that was going on when Hattie Cohens and Brian Mock were firebombed and killed in Salem on September 26, 1992 by neo-Nazis. The two existed side by side. That was the terrain on which they operated.
The terrain Treloar mentions describes two social tendencies, an increase in control and conformity we currently experience as Christian republicanism, and the escalating street violence of right-wing thugs. These trends converged in a crossroads that normalized and valorized hate. Wider approval by anti-gay, anti-immigrant right-wingers primed some of the white working class youth of Portland for recruitment into neo-Nazi fellowship.
Throughout the timeline of this podcast, you will hear people describe events using the language referencing before and after Mulugeta Serra's attack and subsequent death. Serra's murder immediately grabbed the local headlines. It's important to remember he was human. Mulugeta Serra was a young Ethiopian man, a student, a soccer fan, a diligent worker, and a father. With his death, Mulugeta's life became reduced to the event of his murder and unfortunately became synonymous with the politics of his murderers.
It's hard to describe the effect the tragic incident had on Portlanders. It wasn't shock at the brutal murder. This was, after all, a city that had been under a quiet siege. It was the realization that the problem was deeper than the brutes themselves, that the city was not addressing regular attacks on its citizens, that the police ignored ongoing violence of murderous youths, that the only place left to turn was to each other.
After the death of Mulugeta Serra, a group of Ethiopian students in mainly centered around Portland State University called for a rally. And so Ethiopians did the initial organizing, and hundreds of people showed up. And this white guy showed up, asked to speak. So it turned out that was Neil Goldsmith, governor of Oregon. He realized that there's a movement here, and it must be co-opted because there's anger here, and there's also something going on here that's, I'm sure he recognized it as a Jewish man. These are neo-Nazis, and we have to deal with this. So I don't want to completely dismiss his concerns, but just say that from the start, there was always an active effort to take this new movement and put it back in traditional Democratic Party stuff.
But the fascist movement could not be contained by liberal political maneuvering. A political solution would not protect the growing number of people getting assaulted on the streets. Scott Nakagawa and M. Treloar elaborate.
So following the Serra murder, a group called the Coalition for Human Dignity was formed. It was a coalition between the city of Portland and a variety of different community organizations here. At this time, things like the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the Americans Friends Service Committee, the Lesbian Community Project, etc. Groups that were concerned about hate crimes here.
I ended up coming to one of the first couple of meetings of the Coalition for Human Dignity. There were already attempts to draw it into the mainstream of Portland politics. They were meeting in the city council chambers. So people were sitting down and using the same chairs and same mics as the city council and running the meeting that way. I was uncomfortable with it from the start. There's no way that the very people we want to work with are going to want to come in here. But there were already a number of people within the group who wanted to make this part of the normal political process, but at the same time, be anti-fascist. Also, there wasn't a whole lot of clarity about how do we deal with these Nazis? What are we going to do? The real basis of the group had not been laid down. There were 75 people in that meeting and a lot of enthusiasm, but I suspect everybody listening to this podcast has been at a meeting like that. A lot of enthusiasm, but 1 month from now we'll be doing this. That wasn't there at all. There were good, experienced organizers in the group. Susan Wheeler, who unfortunately passed away several years ago, had been in Portland for decades. She'd worked with the Black Panthers in the 1960s and 1970s. She knew what fascist groups were. She came from that classical analysis, so she was there. There were also a bunch of punk kids, sprinkling of college kids as well, who had good hearts and didn't like Nazis.
I'm Stephen Gardner. These days, I once again work as an assistant research director on issues of racial and immigrant justice.
Stephen Gardner came to work at the Coalition for Human Dignity in 1990.
I'm a military veteran. I got out of the Army and almost immediately started doing anti-imperialist, anti-militarism, and peace work. Portland seemed as if it were being invaded by skinheads, by neo-Nazis, boneheads. They were in the music scene. They were intimidating people. They were committing bias crimes. And then there was a murder. So what should we do? And this was the origins of the coalition. Several of the founders were people I'd gone to school with at Lewis and Clark College or friends of mine from various kinds of activist spaces. They asked me, well, would you like to start working with us? Which I did as a researcher at first, a writer, editor. I did a lot of field work inside of neo-Nazi organizations, not the skinhead type, but more Christian patriot sorts of groups. And then eventually became the research director and executive director at Times when there was no one else to do it. The original coalition is important to keep in mind. It was kind of a one-off in the aftermath of the Seurat murder. There were folks, of course, from the religious community, particularly from the Metropolitan Community Churches. There were people from the Jewish community. There were people from the Black community, from the Urban League and from Portland State. That would have been people who came out of Abdi Hassan's classes. Abdi was another immigrant professor from Somaliland. He was one of the founders. So it was a really broad coalition, including folks from the mayor's office, the Metropolitan Human Rights Commission, those kinds of folks as well. So it was actually an uneasy alliance, if you want to think of it that way, because you had folks all the way from city government and very mainstream institutions to some people who were pretty radical in their politics.
Again, Scott Nakagawa.
That coalition attempted to, address the problem in the community, but fell apart over the desire on the part of people who were in the community in that coalition to go to Idaho to protest the Aryan Nations compound. So the city pulled out of the coalition at that point because they were concerned about insurance liability.
And then after that, a core group of people stayed together and retained the name Coalition, even though it became sort of a standalone organization that mostly worked through forming strategic partnerships with people in the Black community, people in the Jewish community, immigrant community, and LGBTQ space to try to bring folks together to recognize that they were fighting a common battle, whether it was against the neo-Nazi skinheads or against the Oregon Citizens Alliance. Even though we were always clear, these weren't the same enemies, but they were the same kinds of threats to people's dignity and life and to the basic tenets of democracy.
At that point, they hired me to staff the committee and try to rebuild it. I made the decision in part because right around the same time that Seurat murder happened, I was attacked by a group of neo-Nazi skinheads. They didn't harm me in any way, but they did terrify me. You know, it was terrifying. I was riding my bike home from work and they tried to run me off the road. It was very clear to me who they were. If you know the Hollywood Fred Meyer, it wasn't there at the time. What was there was a construction site. And so on a bicycle, I was able to get away. I reported it to the police because friends of mine encouraged me to do it. And a friend who had access to the law enforcement data system asked me about my report and whether I'd filed it. And when I said yes, she told me that it was never actually filed by the police. There's some kind of problem here that's bigger than just a bunch of angry white youth going around and expressing racism. You know, when institutionally the police are not seeming to respond to this, and when the city's concern about insurance liability is preventing it from being able to take coordinated action with members of the community, there just seemed to be a really big problem. The other big issue with the police was that they were also reporting that there were no neo-Nazi skinhead groups in the city of Portland, that there was no organized racist activity and that people were exaggerating it. So the Coalition for Human Dignity formed in order to respond to this problem and specifically created a research operation to monitor and document and report on the activities of neo-Nazi skinheads and professional neo-Nazis.
This new formation of the coalition was younger, leaner, non-institutional, not obliged to appease the city. It critically examined the role of the police turning a blind eye to the violence and targeting of various groups. It stopped trying to win the hearts and minds of liberal Portland and instead turned its efforts towards exposing the fascism police and city officials chronically minimized.
The folks I was working with were the punk kids, the young college folks who I was older than them and had some experience, but they were obviously the ones who were going to drive this grouping. Number one, there's a subculture here in Portland, a punk subculture that we need to drive the boneheads out of. The second thing that the Coalition for Human Dignity did that was different was to openly state we were going to drive the boneheads out of Portland. And that was controversial. People had not said, oh, that's our task, drive them out. The third thing was to say, we're not going to meet in the city council chambers anymore. We had to go out and find a place in the community that ended up being the Metropolitan Community Church, which was also the stronghold of queer organizing for that decade. We could pretty much invite people from every community in Portland there without them feeling intimidated.
Here's Abby Layton.
The Coalition for Human Dignity was born with a dedication to monitor and research right-wing and neo-Nazi activity in the Pacific Northwest. We had a parent group, the Center for Democratic Action, with Lenny Zuskind, who is a genius in terms of this work. And he personally trained the people in the Coalition for Human Dignity to do this type of research.
Leonard Zuskind is a longtime activist and researcher of right-wing and anti-Semitic activity. He is an award-winning author of several books on white nationalist movements. Zuskind's long history in organizing, research, and anti-fascism influenced the coalition's direction towards intelligence gathering and building a broad base of support in the Portland community.
They were building community defense, and that meant getting the community involved. So they held conferences and marches and gave out information, so they weren't just focusing on whatever left group was available. They were focusing on building community defense. It was a wonderful thing to see.
An organizing principle differentiating the Coalition for Human Dignity from other grassroots groups in Portland at the time was a focus on research.
How big is this problem? One of the first things we did was just go out and photograph and count some of the racist neo-Nazi graffiti that was sprouting up all over Portland. And there was a lot of it. And then documenting stuff like how many attacks were actually occurring on individuals, neighborhoods, etc. The coalition started documenting that stuff and started releasing it, and that was very important, and it gave us a basis with which to speak to community groupings, with which to speak to the media, and which amongst ourselves to have some sense of this is going on. Yes, there are hundreds of these people, and to get some idea of the interplay of the various groupings, which did become important a little bit later on.
I came out of a very left-wing activist background. So I was involved in South African anti-apartheid work, Central America solidarity work. I had traveled to Central America in the mid-1980s and did work with solidarity groups around the Sandinistas and against American imperialism there, against the Contra War.
That's Jonathan Mazzocchi. Mazzocchi was a Portland area activist and writer who became one of the primary coordinators of the Coalition for Human Dignity. He was their intelligence director. He led the coalition's research work on neo-Nazis, hate groups, and the religious right.
The Coalition for Human Dignity was, I think, a very genuine, organic expression of a community need to fight an insurgent racist right. So you had community people where we were not public officials. We weren't professionals. And the left in Portland at that time was the Portland Alliance. You know, there was work around farm worker campaigns, anti-racist campaigns. There was the movement to change the name of Union Avenue to MLK Boulevard, which was very controversial. Some of that opposition was racist. My activism in the early 1980s began to take a focus on what at that time and what I continue to believe today to be the two pillars of the American form of fascism. And those two pillars are the Christian right and the white nationalist movement. Those are the two main pillars of American fascism. And if American fascism is ever to totally take power and move into a regime phase, it'll have to go through those two movements. So that's part of what the Coalition for Human Dignity, part of what CHD was formed to focus on, was to have a research-driven approach to fighting the right.
There was a board of directors that was made up of a group of very active community leaders here. So I basically supported their leadership, and we built around us a rapid response team and a youth organizing program and a variety of other things. But we did those things together. In Oregon, there were at the time about 24 white nationalist organizations, what we used to call white supremacist organizations, that were active throughout the state. They weren't just neo-Nazi groups. We quickly discovered that in order to track the neo-Nazi groups, we needed to have a statewide operation in order to get a sense of the whole of what was happening. We also needed to look at the activities of groups a little bit closer to the mainstream, like the Oregon Citizens Alliance, and we began monitoring and doing research on them. We tracked the evangelical right here and actually published a report on them called Rolling Back Civil Rights, the Oregon Citizens Alliance at Religious War. We published something called Organized White Supremacy in Oregon that was authored by Jonathan Mazzocchi. We reported on these things to the media. We reported on them to community organizations, and we mobilized people to take action by joining demonstrations, doing some door knocking, organizing rallies, things like that. Some of the direct action things we did were to identify where key neo-Nazi organizers were employed or lived, and then protesting at those sites in order to put some pressure on their employers and landlords. That worked to some extent, but you know, we did a variety of those kinds of things.
I went to Lewis Clark. That's how I got involved. I wasn't as core as like Scott, Jonathan, Pat. I wasn't a person who went to meetings and knew the big picture.
That's Gillian, another Lewis and Clark College student involved in the early formation of the Coalition for Human Dignity.
There's official mainstream rallies and community organizing work. And then, of course, the intelligence gathering work that Jonathan was heading up and Steve was really involved in. And I did a little bit support here and there with informers that were in various organizations. I think the intelligence gathering was really important. That's something that helped with preventing violence against people of color and helped put together the pieces of who all the different on-the-ground players were and where they lived and knowing what cars they drove and doing some following of them, figuring out like what their plans were. I can think of instances where a group of people I worked with did things like disabling neo-Nazis' cars in order to reduce the possibility for gatherings that neo-Nazis were holding in a public venue. Then there was a part of it that seemed to me really crucial, which was supporting the people who were most directly in the line of fire and were the alternative posed to neo-Nazis, and being physically present, just showing up and helping separate or barring doors. That physical presence was helpful. I mean, another way of physically presence was keeping close track of neo-Nazi graffiti, which was exploding everywhere, and doing counter graffiti. The idea was not taking the city approach of covering it over with white paint, but leaving it there to be seen so that people were aware this was occurring and countering it with counter messages. I wouldn't want neo-Nazis to feel like this power structure was against them, but actually that their views were not welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews for this episode were by Annette Newell, Selena Flores, Claire Risciotto, Ender Black, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Mike Crenshaw and Selena Flores. It Did Happen Here is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
It was a very different time in the city of Portland. There was very little young leadership, and we were all people in our 20s when we first started out with the CHD. And we were a racially diverse group of people in the leadership of that organization. All of those things made us interesting and different to people, and allowed us to be able to exploit all of the different connections that we had in order to be able to make these relationships happen.
Welcome to episode 4 of It Did Happen Here, part 2 of Building Community Defense.
I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. This episode again focuses on the Portlanders who came together in response to neo-Nazi violence after the 1988 murder of Mulugeta Seraw and formed the Coalition for Human Dignity.
Again, here's Scott Nakagawa.
There was also longtime leadership in the organization who made a really big difference to us in grounding our politics and helping us to understand what it was that we were doing and who we should be relating to. So among those people was Susan Wheeler, who passed away a number of years ago. She was the treasurer of the CHD. She did all of our bookkeeping for us for years for free out of her living room. She was at one point partnered to somebody named Don Hammerquist. And Don Hammerquist is a historically significant actor in politics in the United States, in that he's a person who is one of the fathers of the radical anti-fascist movement.
Yeah, he's the founder of this Sojourner Truth Organizing Committee in Chicago.
Yes. Right. He also was the leader of the Communist Party USA in Portland. Susan helped him to organize the chapter here and was particularly large and, I guess, active chapter. I don't know that much about that part of that history. After they separated, Susan went down south and met Ronnie Williams and helped him to escape extradition back to Alabama from Oregon once they settled here. Mm-hmm. That effort, having been successful, then brought her to attention of the American Indian Movement, and so she was involved in things like the Lautenberg-Regner Offense Defense Committee and the Justice for Dennis Banks Committee. That historic work of hers and then work she did in the peace movement was really useful to us because it helped us to understand police repression. It helped us to understand just political organizing strategy in general. People don't give her very much credit because she was a very quiet person who, behind the scenes, would make contributions to the organization, but with without her, I'm not sure the CHD would have been able to survive its early years because, you know, the 20-somethings who were the most visible people involved didn't have the strongest basis in organization building. So, you know, it was an intergenerational thing. And I would highly recommend to people now to think about that, that there are people of the older generation whose deep experience in community can be very, very informative.
A core strength of the Coalition for Human Dignity was an ability to cross-pollinate. With intergenerational, queer, and multiracial leadership, the CHD built bridges across Portland's divergent activist community. Its many relationships to other groups extended the influence of the coalition far beyond its membership roster.
The CHD did have a lot of contact with a lot of different groups. I was a staff person of the CHD. I was also a member of ACT UP in Portland. I had a very strong relationship with leadership at the Lesbian Community Project and in a variety of other places in the city. My connections became the organization's connections, and the organizational leadership at the board level also brought many relationships to the organization. The Lesbian Community Project, at the time at which the CHD was working actively with them, was led by a woman named Donna Redwing, who recently passed away, sadly. Donna and I basically conceived of this homophobic violence documentation project and did a little speaking tour around the city to talk to different groups of people about it, assembled a small volunteer base, and then the project got developed at this Lesbian Community Project with a core of volunteers at the head of it. That was basically how that worked. Mm-hmm. The CHD also helped to create a bridge between ACT UP Portland and groups like Anti-Racist Action and Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Mm-hmm. So we introduced those people. We were kind of the bridge organization. organization there. It's always the case, in my experience, that LGBTQ people can, if allowed to, serve as bridges, because LGBTQ community is a cross-class, multiracial community made up of people from every walk of life. So your relationships, of course, are going to be cross-cutting.
Scott brings up an important piece of the coalition's mandate, that it was about relationships. We see today how easy it has become to polarize and divide ourselves from each other. From the beginning, the Coalition for Human Dignity fundamentally understood the importance of relationship building. Community defense is as much founded in mobilizing alliances as in deterring adversaries. With effective bridge building, the Coalition demonstrated multiple strategies to uproot white supremacy.
The legacy of white supremacy today is structural racism, which is the way that society is organized. The fact that communities are located where they are relative to services, the pattern of investment, the representation that people of color enjoy within various different kinds of institutions. It is cultural, it's political, it's economic, it dictates where you live, it dictates a variety of things about you. People don't often know that the one most powerful determinant of one's success in life is your original zip code. So in a segregated society, that makes a really big difference by race. That system of inequality continues, but that's a historical construct. Nobody who is alive now was part of creating that. The original blueprint was created by entirely different people. The thing is that while we were not the architects of structural racism, we are its inheritors, and we don't all inherit the same thing as a result of this legacy. Some of us inherit real assets and privileges, and others of us have inherited terrible disadvantages. In our lifetimes, we get to determine whether or not we will pass that legacy on to yet another generation. In order to avoid doing that, we need to understand that we have to take on anti-racism as a first principle in progressive politics and at all times, because our future is contingent on our being able to work together.
The rest of the episode is from It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final, where Scott Nakagawa and Eric Ward talked together at an event sponsored by the Multnomah County Library. Scott was the first staff person of the Coalition for Human Dignity and is co-founder and senior partner of Change Lab, a national racial equity thinking and acting lab promoting innovation in racial equity and advocacy. In 1990, Eric Ward founded and directed a community project to expose and counter hate groups and respond to bigoted violence with the Community Alliance of Lane County. He is currently the executive director of the Western State Center. This Zoom talk was recorded March 4th, 2021, and starts with Scott Nakagawa reading a comment that was put in the chat.
Afro and Indigenous futurists remind us that we can only create what we imagine. And that, I think, is really important. We need to be wildly imaginative and radically rethink the world we're in, and in particular, to think about safety. Because what people, many of us, are struggling for is safety. We want to be able to feel safe in a world that's rapidly changing, with technological marvels popping up all around us that are constantly changing the way we understand ourselves and how we relate to others. That and climate change and all of these other things that we're facing, the anxiety that that's producing, we need to radically rethink safety in order to be able to get through this. And that's going to have to be a collective exercise. It's time for us to let people ask us questions. Look at who's in the question box. Cecil Prescott.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Cecil was on this Coalition for Human Dignity, and who, well, I mean, I got everything from grammar lessons to organizing lessons from Cecil. But Cecil says, comment on the changing self-understanding of white evangelicalism. It's morphing into Christian nationalism and its current relationship to white nationalism, OCA to the Tea Party, to and OCA being the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which is a more traditional evangelical right-wing group, to the Tea Party, to Trumpism. So
Scott, let me set this up. No. One of the things that I think folks may not be aware about the Coalition for Human Dignity, it didn't just research and help communities organize and respond to neo-Nazism. It was also working with communities who were responding to attacks on the LGBTQ community. And I also think other work as well. talk a little bit first about some of the areas of CHD, help build out the areas, and then answer Cecil's question, because I'm curious what the answer is.
CHD also took on the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which is a group that Cecil just referenced in his question. The Oregon Citizens Alliance being an evangelical right-wing organization that sponsored ballot measure 8 in 1988 that rolled back Governor Neil Goldschmidt's executive order banning discrimination against LGBTQ people in public employment. And then in 1992 presented us with another ballot measure called ballot measure 9, and then subsequently hit the ballot a number of other times on LGBTQ questions and questions of abortion or abortion access. We did some research into the Oregon Citizens Alliance. Steve Gardner, who is on the podcast, authored something called Rolling Back Civil Rights, which is a very important report that helped to contextualize who they were, what they were doing, and what they might do. That was used by the campaign. I went to the campaign and was the director of statewide development on that campaign staff, so I know we used that document. So that was part of what we, you know, understood to be the assault that we were facing. And that evangelical right-wing movement did have a kind of an underground and what you might call a paramilitary wing. Yeah, so we did that as well. I think that that was really important work. There was a lot of organizing around it. And during that campaign year, CHD played a pretty critical role. They published a little newspaper about the Oregon Citizens Alliance that got circulated through another organization called the Rural Organizing Project, also still in existence. People should look that up online, Rural Organizing Project. They do terrific work in rural Oregon. I think that that newspaper had a really good role, played a really good role in helping to consolidate a base of resistance that was informed about the OCA and what it intended to do in a lot of rural communities around the state.
So now I'm going to ask Cecil's question. What is this term Christian nationalism? How does it relate to the Tea Party? How does it relate to white nationalism?
We are faced with a Christian right-wing movement that has a number of different expressions, one of which is a kind of theocratic agenda. And then there's Christian nationalism, which is related, but slightly different. And Christian nationalism is basically the religious expression of white nationalism. Essentially, the notion that we need to basically take over and the nation and create a kind of welcome mat for the second coming of Jesus so that when he returns, we will have created the ecclesia on earth, and that begins here at home. But the Christian nationalist movement has evolved a lot since those old days. I think it helps to understand where they started, right? In the latter part of the 20th century, the biggest social movement in the United States was the born-again evangelical Christian movement. That born-again movement had tremendous momentum, and it was bringing people to the Christian community, but many of whom were not actually going into the institutional Protestant church in America. They were being brought to the Christian community through television, evangelical television and radio. And so they basically went to church at home. And the elites of the Republican right, the neoliberal elites in particular, people like Phyllis Schlafly, for instance, saw that as an opportunity, because at the time the Republican Party was really on the in the margins of national politics. They had won very few elections in a number of decades. And so the Republicans saw this as an opportunity to create a popular front. And so they basically intervened into the in that community and started to help to build a kind of political base for a family values agenda that they believed would be able to divide the liberal opposition to Republican politics and also create the kind of ground troops they needed in order to move their agenda. And so that happened over a number of decades. By 1980, it was key to the election of Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan, who was elected by the Coalition on Revival, which was a group of different kinds of Christian right-wing organizations that included things like Concerned Women for America, which at the time was the largest women's organization in the United States. They were able to kind of make a change within the Christian community that caused evangelical Christians, or a big faction of them, particularly white evangelical Christians, to start to see their role in the world not as simply cultivating a relationship with Jesus, personal relationship with Jesus, and a faith relationship with the with Christianity, but to think of themselves as having to be political actors in order to prove their relationship. They needed to be able to change the world in order to invite Christianity to become the dominant ideology of the United States and the world. And so it politicized them and mobilized them in a way that they hadn't been mobilized before. And that had the impact that we've seen over the last many decades. Lately, they're going in a much more radical direction. And, you know, when we think about, for example, this pandemic we've just been through, and that's one of the horsemen of the apocalypse, right? They hear the sound of those little hoofs on the horizon and are reacting. And so we're likely to see them rise to greater and greater levels of activity. But very importantly, we should know that the Christian right, the Christian nationalist movement, were critical to the election of Donald Trump in 2016. And so when you think about the vulgar, creepy, anti-Christian ideology of Donald Trump, the fact that the Christian nationalist movement in the United States played the kingmaker role in that 2016 election on his behalf and regard him as a godly man is an indication of the direction it's going in. And that direction is one that we should be very, very wary of. It is really dangerous, and it is part of the process of, you know, it sets up the process in which the Christian right and the white nationalist movement appear to be increasingly merging. So that's my answer.
That's a good answer. And see, so it's, I'm glad you answered that one.
Looky, looky. Jeff Nowakowski is in the queue, and Jeff Nowakowski should be acknowledged for having played a very critical role as well, because he was back then the executive director of your organization, Eric, the Western States Center.
Founder.
And the Western States Center was an incubator of the Coalition for Human Dignity. They like took us kids and turned us into adults. So that was really...
And Basic Right to Oregon, is that right?
Well, Basic Right...
Through the Oregon Democracy Project, right? I'll find out. Someone's going to write me a letter and tell me. Someone will get me straight on that. On that one, because I'm curious. Talk about the origins, the timeline of these different organizations. Like, how broad were like some of these coalitions?
Well, so Basic Right Oregon started out as something called Support Our Community's Political Action Committee, which came out of a campaign against an anti-LGBTQ ballot measure in, I think, 1994. And so, you know, it was around that time that finally the LGBTQ community got it together and decided that we were being attacked so often we needed a statewide organization to protect us. And Basic Rights Oregon was the ultimate articulation of that process. And they are a model for the country. People should, who are looking for a political organization that protects the rights of LGBTQ people, look them up online. They do incredibly good work. But what Jeff is asking that I think is useful is, he said, interesting you mentioned democracy as a solution, since right now there's a determined assault on democratic rule itself, defense of minority rule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and I want to actually address that question.
Yeah, can I before you address it, Scott, can I just add to that really quickly? Uh-huh. I think this is a pro tip. I don't know, folks may disagree. Pro tip, right? When folks who say they want to engage in a genocide of 3/4 of the world's population, right, and want to rid all people of color and immigrants and Jews from the country through physical intimidation and harassment, when they tell you they don't like democracy, maybe we want to take a different look at that. Maybe we not want to be so quick to disregard democracy and its practice. Am I wrong? Go ahead. Answer Jeff's question, but I'm just curious. Pro tip.
I agree with you. I think Asher Taylor has written a book called something about democracy, basically saying that we will miss it when it's gone, right? You may not be so sure about it, but we'll miss it when it's gone. You look her name up in your bookstore browser, Asher Taylor. It's a great read. But
I think, get it from Powell's. I mean, but sorry, or an independent bookstore.
Powell's. But the
Portland Law.
The thing is that, you know, people are saying that democracy is being rejected around the world. I argue that people aren't rejecting small d democracy. they're rejecting the basically BS that has substituted for small d democracy around the world all of this time. And the ability to hold people together in the world in the United States around the American dream, which seemed much realer to people and something that crosses class and race, you know, some belief to one degree or another that, you know, the American dream is possible, that carrot gets pulled. And the treadmill you're on, the little rat race you're in, starts to feel like some serious crap, right? And some combination of that process is what people are rejecting. They're rejecting in the United States the idea of nationality on one side because they say that the demographic change is corroding the idea of nationality, which they think is a white construct, right? And on the other side, because nationality has never really included us. Democracy requires a constituent we. And the constituent we that has been imposed upon us is only one that we have been able to continue to hold in place through coercion. Because too many of us have been excluded from it. Too many of us have viewed being part of it as merely an act of consent or of a concession, as opposed to something we have embraced. And as the ability of the center to hold us there has weakened over time, people are now rejecting it. And so I think, you know, democracy is the solution, but the democracy that we have is something we need to protect in order to fight again another day for something much, much better, more inclusive, and more wholly satisfying to people. You know, we need real pluralism. We need an equitable democracy. And I would argue that what we need to do is build democracy from the ground up as a local project in places like Portland, Oregon. That project has to be a feminist project because democracy cannot just be in the public sphere, but in the private sphere in order to be durable, in order to be able to endure the winds of, climate change and all the disasters that we may face in the near future. And that democracy needs to be one that is something that we recreate as we go through it, as an iterative process of negotiation. And it has to be one that's identity forward. We need to be able to acknowledge race. We need to be able to acknowledge gender and sexuality, gender identity, all of the differences in that process, because they're real. And we need a constituent we that can hold us together in which people feel whole, because that's what makes that durable. And we need to build it from the ground up. And it needs to reach for local governance. It needs to reach for the city government and needs to try to scale up from there. And so, I think that that's one of the things that we need to do in order to claim this moment. The analogy I like to use with people is of a kind of managed forest, you know, that what white settlers created in the United States is kind of a managed forest in which the noxious elements, the right wing, that with their anti-democratic ideas are a key element. And because they're native to that forest, it's a difficult place for those of us who have come here by hook or by crook or were already here to thrive in that forest. But that forest is what we're in. And so we need to try to figure out how to contain those noxious elements through monitoring and reporting, through some weeding, and through inoculation campaigns that keep us from eating the poison fruit or carrying the seeds around and spreading them around the forest in ways that would actually help to encourage that those noxious elements to take over. At times like now, when they're surging, we need to have people standing on the front line, vigilant and letting us know that it's happening so we can be aware of it. But we also need to be investing in the best elements of the forest, the parts of it.
Scott, I'm looking at the time. I know we got a couple of minutes left. I want to say really quickly, when we think about that, one of the things I would leave folks with is to remember, right? It took literally a city, and it took a state, and it took a region to take on the white nationalist movement. It wasn't just in Portland, right? It was in places like Coeur d'Alene, Casper, Wyoming, right? It was, and it wasn't just a left program in this country, right? It was a broad political spectrum of folks who may not have agreed on anything except for the fact that neo-Nazism wasn't the answer, to the problems that faced us. And it was value-based, right? It doesn't mean that there weren't folks with ideology, but there were folks who had no ideology, but had values, and space was made for those individuals. And it was folks who maybe did something once a month, and it was folks who lived in the warehouse on $400 a month. And so just to say to folks, you know, think big and take yourself seriously in this moment. You know, I used to play a game when I was a kid called If I Were. And Scott, you know this, I've told you about this, right? We'd sit, you know, it was August, you know, school hadn't started. We were out of things to do. We had no money, right? So we would just say, we play this game. If I were in the lion's cage and the lion got in, here's what I would do. We'd argue about what we would do. And the question that would come up every summer is, if I were in the midst of the 1960 civil rights movement, here's what I would do. We would argue as kids, right? We were full of bravado about what we would or wouldn't put up with. We didn't understand the choiceless choices of our parents who like lived under Jim Crow. And that question has always haunted me. What would I have done? And I hope that question haunts everyone listening today. But the truth is, whatever it is you would do, you would have done in the 1960s is what you will do when you get off this program today. Make it count. Remember what Audre Lorde said, you do not disassemble the master's house with the master's tool. White supremacy and white nationalism have been built off of 500 years of violence. We know what that looks like. We know where that leads. It is time for a new vision that is an alternative to white supremacist violence. And quite frankly, I don't think we get there through violence, but that is my take. That is what I learned. I hope folks get a chance to listen to the podcast that It Did Happen Here, podcast.com. Give it your own listen. Let us know what you think. Scott, appreciate you. Multnomah County Library, support your county library, right? Scott, always a pleasure, my friend. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Annette Newell, Selena Flores, Claire Risciotto, Ender Black, and Aaron Yankee. And your hosts were Mike Crenshaw and Selena Flores. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to Lindsay Runyon and Enrique Rivera of the Multnomah County Library, the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further